Following are some comments on William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, Act 1. If you be out, sir, I can mend you. The people make holiday to see Caesar. In Act 1, Scene 1, Shakespeare's 1599 play, Julius Caesar, kicks off our look at ancient Rome by showing us a group of common people, or plebeians, engaging with two tribunes during the Feast of Lupercalia in 45 BCE. This holiday involves sacrifices, feasting, and a ritual whereby male runners lightly strike the wrists of female bystanders with a cord. It's a fertility ritual, a prayer for Roman society's perpetuation. Ordinary customs and laws are tacitly suspended, and the common people are enjoying their temporary idleness. A cobbler, or shoe repairman, jests when he's grilled by Flavius. Quote unquote, I beseech you, sir, be not out with me. Yet if you be out, sir, I can mend you. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 16 through 17. No doubt, both tribunes, though officers of the people, believe commoners should know their places. But Flavius and Marellus are not as annoyed about the Lupercal feast as they are about the triumph granted to Caesar over the killing of Pompey's sons, Roman citizens, at Munda, Spain. Flavius and Marellus clearly favored the Pompeian faction within the now defunct first triumvirate of Caesar, Pompey, and Crassus, and they're upset to see the people favoring Caesar. The tribunes seem certain that their own words and gestures, mainly removing the crowns placed upon Caesar's statues by his adherents, will set things right. Caesar had already violated Roman precedent in January of 49 BCE by crossing the Rubicon River and entering Italy with his army. Now, having started a civil war in Italy and situated himself as Rome's permanent dictator, Caesar constitutes a grave threat to the Republic. The problem isn't just with Caesar. Rome had long been beset by powerful factions led by the likes of the autocratic Sulla and the populist Marius, several decades before the Republic's demise. These rulers were not republicans, they were strongmen, and their supremacy led to bloodletting and mass proscriptions, or confiscations of property and wealth. The Roman Republic had long been in trouble before Caesar toppled it. Marellus points out to the commoners that they once adored Pompey, quote unquote, many a time and oft have you climbed up to walls and battlements, ellipsis, and there have sat the livelong day with patient expectation to see great Pompey pass the streets of Rome. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 36 through 41. The scene ends with Flavius telling Marellus, quote unquote, these growing feathers plucked from Caesar's wing will make him fly an ordinary pitch. Who else would soar above the view of men and keep us all in servile fearfulness? Act 1, Scene 1, lines 71 through 74. Flavius is mistaken. Caesar will never fly an ordinary pitch. Beware the Ides of March. Caesar brushes aside a soothsayer and reluctantly refuses a crown, while Brutus and Cassius consider their options. When we first catch sight of him in Act 1, Scene 2, Julius Caesar seems a grand figure, casually ordering VIPs around. Still, what Caesar says to Antony during his Lupercal procession reminds us that his wife, Calpurnia, is unable to have children. Julius is human after all. He's alone in an admiring crowd, and we can see that he depends on Mark Antony's guidance and friendship. Caesar seems to credit the fertility-based supernatural underpinnings of the Lupercal festival, but thanks to a combination of vanity and the genuine fearlessness of an experienced military man, he will not listen to a soothsayer's plea to, quote-unquote, beware the Ides of March. Act 1, Scene 2, line 23. Caesar calls the fellow, quote-unquote, a dreamer, and the procession rolls on. Act 1, Scene 2, line 24. But two patricians, Brutus and Cassius, remain aloof from the procession, and their first conversation involves the key Roman concept of honor. Cassius asks Brutus if he can see himself. The reply Brutus gives reminds us how difficult it is for a person to be truly self-aware. Brutus says, quote-unquote, "The eye sees not itself, but by reflection, by some other things." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 52 through 53. This worthy Roman has been thinking along the same lines as Cassius, though in a nobler strain. He would not have Caesar become a king. The Romans haven't had kings for hundreds of years, back when the Etruscans imposed the line of Tarquin kings on them. What about Cassius? He freely admits to Brutus that he both resents and envies Caesar, and holds him in contempt even as he marvels at the man's success, recounting a time when Caesar challenged him to a swim in the choppy waters of the Tiber. Cassius refers to Virgil's Aeneid, putting himself in place of Aeneas and casting Caesar as the hero's enfeebled father Anchises, who had to be carried by his son from the burning, defeated Troy. Cassius says with disdain, quote-unquote, "So from the waves of Tiber did I the tired Caesar, and this man is now become a god." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 114 through 116. Cassius doesn't seem to care much about justice. He would probably jump at an opportunity to take power himself, at least vicariously through Brutus. He also sees a disjunction between what ordinary people think Caesar is and what he actually is to those who know him. In this, he seems correct. Caesar's image with the public is not who he really is, even if that's hardly unusual for a high-ranking politician. We like to think of the Romans as upstanding and ancient times as simpler and more noble, but Roman political culture was at least as sophisticated as ours. Spin would hardly have been foreign to Roman politicians. Cassius tries to stir resentment in Brutus, so he reminds him of his illustrious ancestor, Lucius Junius Brutus, who helped drive out the last Tarquin king from Rome. Brutus is naive about his friend's motives. He will, he tells Cassius in a passage full of dramatic irony, "find an appropriate time," quote-unquote, "to hear and answer such high things." Act 1, Scene 2, line 170. But Cassius's motives are nowhere near upright. Brutus, the idealist, transforms everyone around him so that they seem purer than they are, which operation makes Brutus himself vulnerable to exploitation. As the holiday procession continues, Caesar speaks to Antony again and makes it clear that he does not trust prideful Cassius. Evidently, Caesar surrounds himself with people willing to tell him whatever he wants to hear. A quip often attributed to Alice Roosevelt Longworth goes something like, "If you have nothing good to say about anyone, sit right here next to me," quote unquote. Well, Caesar, the great favorite of Lady Fortune, would agree. He criticizes the, quote unquote, "lean and hungry look of Cassius." Act 1, Scene 2, 194. Then he invites Antony to tell him the latest gossip about the man, quote unquote, "Come on my right hand, for this ear is deaf, and tell me truly what thou thinkst of him." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 13 through 14. This lover of gossip has just finished declaring himself fearless, saying, quote unquote, "I rather tell thee what is to be feared than what I fear, for always I am Caesar." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 211 through 212. There is an always-on quality to Caesar that seems to fit with Casca's comments about the great man's bit of street theater in the presence of the common people, with a best supporting actor assist from Antony. Casca, tells Cassius and Brutus that in this theatrical interlude, Antony offered Caesar a crown 3 times, and Caesar refused it, though each time a little more reluctantly. After the 3rd refusal, the crowd became agitated and caused Caesar to have an epileptic fit. Casca describes the scene as follows, quote unquote, "He fell down in the marketplace and foamed at mouth and was speechless." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 249 through 250. Casca is scornful of the common people because they would gladly make Caesar king. The quote-unquote tag-rag crowd seems like an ordinary Elizabethan rabble. They follow their own appetites and are greedy for emotional spectacle. It is easy to see the implications of Shakespeare's representation of Rome's plebeians if these are the people who must ultimately keep Rome worthy of its freedom. The Eternal City is in serious trouble. Cassius draws the lesson, it isn't Caesar who is sick, it's everyone else. He tells Brutus and Casca, quote unquote, "Caesar hath it not, but you and I, and honest Casca, we have the falling sickness." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 252 through 253. There's also chilling news from Casca, who says that the tribunes Marellus and Flavius have been thrown out of office for stripping the crowns from Caesar's statues. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 278 through 279. At the end of Act 1, Scene 2, Cassius, alone, clarifies for us how he plans to win Brutus to a conspiracy to kill Caesar. The plan is to manipulate Brutus further by taking advantage of his honesty, patriotism, and stature as a descendant of Lucius Junius Brutus. Cassius has made progress, but there's work to be done, so he says, quote unquote, "I will this night, in several hands, in at his window throw," ellipsis, "writings, all tending to the great opinion that Rome holds of his name." Act 1, Scene 2, lines 308 through 309, and 311 through 312. Brutus won't be able to resist the call of Cassius's screeds, purporting to come from fellow citizens. 3 parts of him is ours already. Cassius wins Casca to the cause and vows to bring Brutus around. In Act 1, Scene 3, the statesman Cicero proves unwilling to buy into breathless talk about prodigies and omens. He believes it's all a matter of interpretation. As he says, quote unquote, "Men may construe things after their fashion, clean from the purpose of the things themselves." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 34 through 35. Casca fears the omens, but Cassius is more aggressive about what they portend. "Caesar is," says Cassius, quote unquote, "no mightier than thyself or me in personal action, yet prodigious grown and fearful as these strange eruptions are." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 76 through 78. A Roman confronts fears, and if captivity looms, the Stoics offer a remedy, quote unquote, "That part of tyranny that I do bear, I can shake off at pleasure." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 99 through 100. Cassius thinks Caesar's greatness is a mark of the people's degeneracy. But doesn't this betray the conspiracy's weakness? If Cassius's contemporaries are merely we the sheeple, as we say today, how can they maintain the ancient republic, even if an assassination creates a chance to restore it? If the people are fit only to be led, the argument is about who will dominate them, not the virtues of self-rule. As Thomas Carlyle will later write, quote unquote, "In the long run, every government is the exact symbol of its people." Perhaps democracies die when the citizenry are no longer worthy of such noble experiments. This is not to say that Shakespeare or his audience were sympathetic to republican government. Monarchy was considered the best form of rule. Or perhaps they thought, as Winston Churchill said of democracy in a 1947 speech to Parliament, it was, quote-unquote, the worst form of government except for all those other forms of government that have been tried from time to time. When Cinna arrives, Cassius gives him several letters and tells him to place them where Brutus is sure to find them and suppose that the people desire him to act. Cassius's rhetoric convinces Casca to join up. He and Cassius want to borrow Brutus's connection to Roman heroism, thinking it will render their own deeds noble. As Casca says, quote unquote, "That which would appear offense in us, his countenance, like richest alchemy, will change to virtue and to worthiness." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 158 through 160. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Friday, May 30th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.